Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2021, and tonight's topic is the foreword from the book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent. I'm going to go through, like I did, The Audacity to Be You. I'm going to go through each chapter, and in between each chapter, we'll have a question and answer. So that's going to run over the next 18 weeks, or 9 to 18 weeks, depending upon whether or not I do one or two sessions per week. So with that, if I don't get to the questions by the end of tonight, Malia will save them, and I'll get to them during the next broadcast. That'll be the question and answer. For those of you that are listening to the broadcast, you might sense or hear a different sound in my voice. I'm coming off a little cold. I sound worse than I feel. I feel great, much better than I did last night when I had to cancel. But I may have a couple of coughs and sneezes as we go along. So thanks for joining me this evening. Like I said last night, I am very excited about this broadcast because I hadn't broken apart the book chapter by chapter, all the way through ever. I'd done a few of the chapters. Some of the chapters from this first book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, came out of the most popular broadcast that we had. But we had so much success with it when we were dealing with The Audacity to Be You, and so many people responded positively that we thought we'd go through this. I'll start with this. You know, back before the book came out, I think it came out in 2016, I want to say, maybe 15. I'd been doing these broadcasts for a while, had a lot of online content, and people were asking me to write a book. And, you know, my first struggle was that's a really hard thing to do. I'd never written a book, and they don't seem like they're an easy thing to do. But then after I considered it, I thought, I don't know what I would write about. I mean, there are so thousands and tens of thousands, maybe more than 100,000, I'm not sure, parenting books out there, books on parenting. And so it didn't feel like I had something unique to talk about. But I thought about it. I thought, what would make my book unique if I were to write it? And I realized that there were a couple of things that I have that nobody else in the world has. And number one is, I have my story. Nobody in the world has my story. And I have the unique vantage point of watching families as they go through crises to stabilization, to repairing and improving their lives. With that, I thought, I'll try to write this. And first and foremost, I wanted to write something that was different than other people have written in terms of what kind of advice it offered. So many parenting books, and I'll talk about this throughout this book, so many parenting books, in my opinion, give you formulas that they imply that if you follow the formula, you can fix or really hear the word control your child. And I'd long since learned that that's not really the work that we're doing. But there is a systemic participation with our children that can make the problems, you know, add to the problems, or that can remove our negative impact or the way that we contribute to the problem. So this book is not an advice book. None of the work that I do is advice work. I cannot answer the question, what should I do? Which gets asked to me, and I imagine most therapists or folks in mental health all the time, every day. It's not my job to answer what can I do, but what I did think was, it's my job to teach you how to think about the question that you have so that you can come up with your answer from your truth. I've shared this, that when I teach the work that I teach so often over the years, parents have responded this way, and this is the first paragraph from the foreword to the book. When I teach parents, often someone will say, I wish I had this information when my children were young. Unfortunately, when something is not immediately relevant, we usually pay very little attention to it. And then I said this, the experience of parenting a struggling child is the most powerful way that we learn. It offers us something that we cannot get any other way. There's a shift in this work. And this is important no matter where you are in the stage. There's a shift in this work from wishing you were back on track to realizing that you're where you need to be and that the lessons that are available to you in this struggle, albeit painful and difficult and lonely at times, that they're the lessons that you need for your life. And leaning into that idea, I always say when I teach a new group of parents, if you can just for these couple of hours, imagine, even pretend that you're not off track. If you can imagine that you're where you need to be, you also then get the lessons that part of your journey has to offer. So tonight, as we embark on the book, the Journey of the Heroic Parent, I'm going to tell a little bit about my story, about how I got into it, and then kind of set the stage for the chapters that I took from the broadcast that people seem to respond most positively to over the years. You know, when I got the job in wilderness therapy, if you read this chapter, I was looking for a job. I was at the point that I'd finished my my master's degree, and I was finishing up my PhD coursework, and I was ready for an internship. And one of my professors, who had his son at a program, a wilderness program, asked me to give it a try. And then others from our program had worked for a wilderness therapy program. I had no idea what that meant. I was not a camping, outdoorsy person growing up. I surfed, went to the beach, but that's about as rough as it got for me. So I tried to call. I tried to reach them. I couldn't reach anybody at the office. And eventually, I just drove down one day and just to check it out. It was about 2.5 hours from in the middle of nowhere from where I lived at the time. And as luck would have it, the day I arrived, the person that I ended up replacing had quit his job on the spot. He'd gotten lost on his way out to the group and just felt overwhelmed and ended up quitting his job. And that was the easiest interview that I think I've ever been in my life, where they needed somebody. They already had students in the group, and I happened to be there that day. I couldn't imagine learning all that I've learned since then in the past 25 years. You know, we've all heard the saying, we don't know what we don't know, but further or more fundamental to that, we don't even know how to get it. So at times I write in that we look back on our life and all of it kind of fits together and makes sense. It becomes this beautiful tapestry. But at the time in our life, we're kind of drawn into these experiences, these relationships, and these circumstances where the unconscious part of ourselves is trying to heal us and trying to teach us what we know. Going back to raising struggling children, that's part of what it is. It is our unconscious mind setting up our life in such a way to teach us the exact lessons that we need to know. So I had the good fortune to end up in a wilderness therapy program, and it, of course, has forever altered my life and my family's life, and of course, many others as we eventually started our own program and evolved the model somewhat. I talk about this, that the thing I was most amazed about, the thing I learned or was most impressed with early on, was how amazing it was that these three or four adults who look like tree-hugging hippies, because most of them are, would go out and live 8 days in a row without a break. I mean, they take a break during the day, but without leaving the wilderness, they would live with these groups for 8 days in a row. And I was amazed at their patience and their resilience in dealing with elements, along with kids that are struggling with mental health and addiction. That's the first big lesson. But the second lesson that I learned was how resilient students were. I learned that these young people are more resilient than they or their parents think that they are. You know, they say, I can't do this. I won't be able to do this. And after a while, I just learned to listen to that with a deepening empathy. But the fact of the matter, as I've watched child after child, client after client, student after student demonstrate resiliency, flexibility, an ability to evolve and to learn, and to find this kind of new normal in the wilderness, this thing where all of your creature comforts are stripped away and you're put out into these very difficult circumstances with people that you don't know, and how these folks were able to really thrive in many cases. I was just saying to the staff today, because I do my staff training every week on Wednesday, we have to remind ourselves that the best teacher in all of our program is the wilderness itself. I had no idea at the time, but during my undergrad, I took a class. It was an elective, but it was fulfilling part of my major. It was an elective within my major. Had a strange name, but I think it must have either the description caught my eye or maybe it was just the only thing that fit my schedule. I don't know why I selected it because it seemed like a strange enough title. It was called Spiritual Life and Temporal Relationships in the Home. Family Psychology 371, and the professor was Dr. Kathleen Barr. I ended up taking it twice because I had some family circumstances. I fell behind and I had to retake it the next semester. And I had no idea at the time that essentially it was going to prepare me for my entire career. Out of one of the notebooks that we have that we were given to the class, there was this story. And this was from an article in 1968. From a journal in 1968. I want to say the Harvard Journal, but I'm not sure right now. And here's the quote. And it's I included it in the beginning chapter to give some context for what wilderness therapy is and what it means. The woman writing the article says this: when my child was 2 or 3, I used to shell peas with her. Nowadays, I buy my peas already shelled and packaged. This saves time and the peas are fresher. But was this all that happened when I shelled peas with my daughter? Did I merely get a dish of peas? It was a total process. And if I am going to see to it that the totality of the important aspects are retained, I shall have to find out what they were and then find the medium through which they can continue to be expressed. We sat early in this class and we watched two documentaries back to back. We had no discussion with them afterwards until the third class. We just watched the documentary. Class ended, we left, and then we watched a subsequent documentary. The first documentary was on a primitive tribe. I think it was in Africa. And, no running water or electricity. And you could see how well the village worked together. And all of the young children stayed with their mothers, the women in the tribe. And when the young men got old enough, they went out to hunt with the fathers and to do some gathering and hunting with the fathers. When the young children were with the mother, they would learn to fish. They would learn to make baskets. They would learn to tend to domestic activities of the village. And the young men, of course, when they were out working with their fathers, they learned all about hunting and gathering. They had stories and songs. At night, they sat around the fire after dinner and they told these stories and they sang these songs. And their stories, their mythology had embedded in it all the lessons that they needed to pay attention to survive. The same way that you and I talk about what you sow is what you reap. What you reap is what you sow. Excuse me. I mean, that's an adage from farming. And since most of us, I suspect none of us are farmers, we borrow from somebody else's culture to remind ourselves of that lesson. And some of those lessons are less apparent in the world that we have today. So we watch this primitive tribe. And then we also watched a documentary on a woman who had won the Mother of the Year in Utah in recent years at the time. And her discipline and organization was head spinning. She ran a daycare. She raised her own children. She had a schedule every day. There was play time. There was learning time. There was snack time. There was nap time. There was lunch time. When the kids were taking their naps and when they were taking their naps and eating lunch, she would clean everything up and set up for the next cycle of activities. There was one important moment when what stood out to us later was at one point when the kids were kind of jumping around and playing rambunctiously in their play area, their playroom, she had them come over and practice formal exercise in calisthenics, right? So she stopped them from sort of naturally exercising and brought them over to have formal exercising. Excuse me. So we watched these two documentaries And we came back, and the professor basically said to us, "What did you see?" And the discussion that unfolded from there was this primitive culture, everything was integrated into it. You didn't have religion over here and how to raise, make a living and feed yourself over here and values and lessons over here. All of it was together. All of it overlapped. Whereas in modern culture, we separate everything out, right? Mom and dad are lawyers or doctors or accountants or history teachers. Right? They go off and they do their thing. And then they come home and they try to teach their children about the law of the harvest. You know, what you reap is what you sow. But because life is kind of disconnected from that natural order of things, the lessons to the children seem contrived. And they have a hard time connecting them because they don't live on a farm. They're not reliant on the inherent lessons of learning to survive. And so these lessons become distant to them. That's why, as children grow older, go out into the world, they start to realize that the laws, the rules, the ideas, the concepts that you had tried to teach them weren't about you. I would explain to the children, it's not like I'm God and I invented gravity. I'm more like Sir Isaac Newton and I'm describing to you how it works. I'm not making up these rules in a sense. I mean, obviously, there are rules in a family, rules in a society, rules in our program, but these rules are based on the kind of natural law, the natural order of things. So the lessons are immediate and they're intertwined with the struggle to survive. There's a great quote in a man who did a wonderful summary of all the wilderness programs in one of his interviews with one of the founders of one of the first wilderness therapy programs. He said this. One of the founders said, "Whenever we adopted what we have come to call contrived experiences in wilderness therapy, the overall impact diminished for the participants." So, like the peas example, these exercises, these lessons that they seem heady and abstract, get very, very real when you're out there in a rainstorm and how you built your shelter, how much time you spent on it. It makes the difference between getting wet and staying dry. You don't have to give a lecture when you're all waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning because everybody didn't build their shelter and the staff are having to get a fire going and keep everybody dry under the large group tarp. The lesson is inherent in the activity. And that's really what wilderness therapy is. It's a primitive reach back into our roots. And it makes the lesson immediate, absolutely relevant. Some of you, if you studied the social sciences in high school or college, you'll remember and be familiar with a gentleman by the name of Abraham Maslow, who was a sociologist. And he described this hierarchy of needs. And he said, you know, at the bottom, there's the basic needs, the physical needs, food, water, and shelter. And he said, if you don't have those taken care of, it's hard to work on the higher, more abstract needs. Up from the physical needs are the need to belong, to be a part of a group. Above that is self-esteem, self-efficacy. And at the top of that is something he called self-actualization, which is kind of coming into your own, being authentically who you are. That's the pyramid, if you will. But what this class taught me in college was that the lessons of esteem, of efficacy, of belonging are inherent in the struggle to survive. How many of you can relate to this, what I'm about to say? How many of you can relate to the fact that some of you weren't given everything growing up? Some of you are self-made and you had to kind of figure it out for yourself. And then you get some academic success or professional success and you have some discretionary income. And then you're trying to teach the child the lesson that you learned, but you learned it through the struggle. And your child doesn't have to struggle the same way that you have to struggle. So we come up with these constructs, these ideas about how to teach our children the lesson, but it's not inherent. Wilderness therapy in this class that I had as an undergrad turned this pyramid upside down or took away all the boundaries and said, it is within the struggle to survive that we learn what it means to be a part of a group. It's within the struggle to survive that we learn what it means to be an individual, to have self-respect and feel like what we do makes a difference. It's within the struggle to survive that we find out who we are. Now, we don't unnecessarily burden children with discomfort. We don't go out of our way. It's inherent. That's why when we started our program in 1998, we improved it dramatically, the creature comforts, from the get-go, because it's already dramatic enough for children to move from indoors and those kinds of things out to the wilderness and have a backpack and be living with a group of other children. Some of you might be familiar with Joseph Campbell and his work. This is where the title of the book comes from. Joseph Campbell was an American philosopher and mythologist who studied all world religions that he could get his hands on. Had an extraordinary encyclopedic knowledge of every myth and religion from every corner of the earth that had ever been recorded. And what he discovered after studying them is that there was only one story in all of them. And he called it the hero's journey or the hero's adventure. And he parsed it into various parts, and the three main parts is the separation, right? To leave your everyday life and to go out into to the wilderness, really. To leave home, to come to the program, to leave the comfort of what you know and walk into an Al-Anon meeting, to have to walk into an AA meeting, to have to walk into a therapist's office, right? You go from the known to the unknown. And there's an initiation. There are steps along the way. There's magical helpers that come into the story. And there's an initiation into this new community, right? Everything starts to shift. You start listening to this broadcast, these broadcasts, and at first they don't make sense, but something is there. And so you keep listening until eventually you find yourself a part of this tribe that understands what this work is that we're doing at Evoke. Again, there are many aspects to this journey. There's a dragon battle that he describes when we fight the dragon of should and shouldn't. And when we slay the dragon of should and shouldn't, then we find the treasure that the dragon was hiding for us. We find the truth. We find in religion God or heaven or nirvana or paradise. But in Joseph Campbell's model, that's not the end of the story. The end of the story is you go back home, you return home to tell people. That's why, you know, it works in AA that after you get sober, you come back and you sit in circles and you tell your story. That's why some of you who have experience and have been on this path for a while come back to share your wisdom and stories with other people. And that's the final stage. That closes the loop. And you can see this in the mythologies and the great stories of all these cultures. So the hero's journey is this place where we leave the known. And literally in our program, you're going out to the wilderness, right? And you're going out to the wilderness and you're struggling to work together as a group. And in that you learn problem solving and empathy and communication, self-efficacy, all the things I'll be talking about tonight. I kind of want to share with you where we've been and where we're at now. There are a few origins of wilderness therapy, like a lot of movements. Different things are going on at different times that kind of all converge together. One of them in the late 1970s was started by a professor at Brigham Young University in Utah, which explains one of the reasons why all these programs started in Utah. We are the Silicon Valley, if you will, in Utah of treatment programs. And so Larry Olson was this professor, and they came to him and they said, look, we have all of these students that are on academic probation. And, you know, he said, look, I've worked with the Boy Scouts for years. I've done some pretty primitive camping. Why don't I take them on a 30-day experience and see if I can't get them to kind of wake up to their own life? So he wrote this letter, and this is actually word for word taken from the letter that he wrote. I think it was 1978. I'm not sure on that, but I think it was around that time. He said, and the letter starts off, "Dear academic dropout, my name is Larry Olson, and I'm inviting you to be a guinea pig to go on a primitive survival class. If you make it back alive, you can return back to Brigham Young University on probation status." And he sent that to 26 students who had been suspended for academic performance. And 26 went out, 26 returned, and all 26 students graduated from their university with a bachelor's degree. So they saw something in this experience. That's kind of where it started. One of the places it started. Take that forward. I shared this last night, if you were on, when I had to take a sick night. NASA and the American United States government is using it with their astronauts. In the podcast by Adam Grant, who's an organizational psychologist, in his podcast called Work Life, from his March 28th, 2018 episode, How to Trust People You Don't Like, he tells the story about how NASA began using primitive living experiences. They even tried kind of contrived games and exercises and team building kinds of activities. But they said nothing was more powerful in creating a vulnerability where you need to trust each other and rely on each other and work out the relationship together. So they started a program where NASA teams that don't have experience with each other, in some cases they're coming from different cultures, different countries, go on this primitive living wilderness trip. And that tells you, from back from Larry Olson's intuitive step into wilderness therapy to where we're at today, the science is catching up, with our intuition. We know now what the metaphor of wilderness small group primitive living is. We know that it takes work. We know it's uncomfortable. We know that the lessons are inherent in the experience. We know that there's no easy emotional escape. You're detoxing from screens, and you're having to deal with this small universe. The way I say it is, it's this small universe that mimics the larger universe. And so the lessons that you learn speak more honestly to you, and it stops becoming about mom and dad, or the teachers, or the police, or any of the other authority figures, and it starts to become about your life. So what makes wilderness therapy so special? I explained the story. I'll tell you a funny story about the book. One of my editors, when they were reading this book, they wanted to take out the entire foreword. They wanted to take out the thing about wilderness therapy, and they definitely wanted to take out the thing about Maslow, which of course led me to firing them. Because I said, I don't think you're reading the book with an understanding about what we're trying to accomplish here. I want to, for the rest of the book, to borrow on my experience from wilderness therapy to talk about the challenges and tasks in parenting and what wilderness therapy can teach us about it. Wilderness therapy uses metaphors. I remember many years ago, I was listening to a commercial. Derek Jeter, if you're a sports fan or a baseball fan, you might know who Derek Jeter is. He's a Hall of Fame shortstop from the New York Yankees. He was the team captain for years and won a couple of world championships. I don't know how many, but he was the consummate professional. And in this commercial I heard many years ago, he was talking about his father teaching him about baseball in Little League. And all he was kind of going through all the lessons that putting the team first matters, and making compromises and sacrifices, and discipline and practice. And he was listing off the things that a good baseball coach would teach a young child. And at the end of the commercial, Derek Jeter said, "It wasn't until later that I realized that my dad wasn't teaching me about baseball, but he was teaching me about life." wilderness therapy, like other metaphors, especially experiential ones, teach you all about life without walking through the front door. When you're walking through the front door with a resistant adolescent or adult for that matter, you're going to get rejection, you're going to get walls. But when you go around the side, oftentimes the most resistant students in my group, I would kind of put the therapy assignments to the side, especially those that were resistant because they were hyper cooperative. I would put those to the side and I would just work on a Bojo fire with them. Where I would watch them in our downtime together in the group, and I would see all of their issues come up. Then they would enter the session. They wanted to show me assignment after assignment that they had done during the week. And I didn't want to talk about those assignments because I wanted to talk about earlier on when they broke their Bojo fire set over their knee out of frustration. Or when they didn't want to work with the group on cleaning up the campsite or whatever it was. And they wanted me to focus on this thing over here, right? But what I want to focus on was what was happening. So metaphor, parables, analogies are a way to bypass resistance because you're not talking about the thing you're talking about. The positive peer milieu, at Evoke is really powerful, not just because it's a small group, but because you need each other. You need the staff. You know, one of the things we do, we teach them how to cook. We bring them out fresh fruits and vegetables every day. They're going to struggle to be comfortable and to survive if they don't have the staff. So the person who's supposed to be teaching you about life, you also need him or her or them to survive. So you're already in a position with them where you are the student and they are the teacher. So the positive peer milieu, the microcosm of life is there. Like I said, resistant adolescents, resistant clients, they show up. Eventually, they expose themselves in the in-between moments. They might be good in therapy session, but eventually, at some time during the group, they will expose themselves and who they are and where they're at on this journey. Self-esteem, a sense of accomplishment, right? There's a big shift from thinking that the problem is out there and the solution is out there to the solution is in me, that I can make a difference in my own life. We talk about that as locus of control, internal versus an external locus of control. Successful folks in business or in sports think that they have the solution. People that are less successful think the solution is out there, that it's luck, that circumstances predict your success. Like I said, the group becomes a microcosm. I can remember my first days with my first student, and we were hiking. And back then, it wasn't yet our program. And you kind of made a backpack out of a tarp and some string and seatbelt webbing. That's how you made it. It's called a survival pack. Really uncomfortable. If you made it really, really well, it was fairly comfortable. If you didn't, or you just threw it together, it could get lopsided and top heavy. And I remember walking on one of the hikes, and I'm talking to this young man, and he was going back and forth between describing his life at home with his parents and his backpack. And eventually, I couldn't tell what he was talking about because it was the same complaint. I don't want to be here. This isn't fair. This is so uncomfortable. This hurts. It's not working. And I started to realize they'll tell us their story by their engagement in the program. You remove the distractions and the defenses. It was relevant back then in the mid-90s, but oh, how much more relevant it is today with screen time and smartphones. People have called it since a digital detox, and that immersion into the primitive environment becomes the process. You can't manipulate Mother Nature. She doesn't argue. She can't be controlled. I remember going out with my son and when he was in wilderness therapy, and I had been a wilderness therapist for over 10 years at that point. But still, I hadn't learned the lessons that I'd been teaching. and I didn't want it to rain, and I didn't want the discomfort and all the things, but that was the teacher, and I had to be with him in it all. I remember one time, this was one of my most profound moments. I always hated October in the wilderness the most because it wasn't cold enough to snow. It was rainy and wet and damp, and it was hard to have a fire. So you weren't in the summer and you weren't in the winter. You were kind of in this ugly in-between point. And I remember one day I was having a hard time staying dry and wet. I had my sleeping bag, I had my shelter. I was trying to get a fire, but the wetness was putting it out, so there was lots of smoke. My eyes were burning. And after my first session, I turned to Stephen, the staff member that was there. I said, Stephen, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to convince me not to have sessions in my car the rest of the day, which is a taboo in wellness therapy. And Stephen just looked at me and he said, you know, just show them how to suffer. Meaning show them how to struggle. Show them how to sit with and move through discomfort. But all he said was show them how to suffer. And I paused and I thought, damn it, that was he made a good case in far less than 30 seconds. And for the rest of the day, I stayed in it. I stayed with them. I don't remember the sessions that happened that day or the things that we talked about, but we all worked on trying to stay comfortable and warm and dry and safe. You know, in the winter, or even in the summer, when the elements are pressing on you, the wilderness is the teacher. I always say wilderness in the winter, in some ways, is an easier program to run because it's doing everything for you. When the weather is ideal, perfect, it kind of can, you can take things for granted. One time I was sitting with staff members and a student came up and he didn't want to take a shower because it was shower day, and then taking a shower in the wilderness takes a lot of work. And he came up, the student came up while we were having a staff discussion, and he said, do I have to shower today? And the staff said, it's an expectation. And then the staff started to lecture him, and I just put my hand up gently. I said, it's okay, you don't have to explain it. Just tell him you know how hard it is. At home, taking a shower is a break. Taking a shower is easy. But in the windy, hot, sandy desert, taking a shower seems futile. But these field guides and these students who, after being with us for a few weeks, several weeks, start to show you that they just don't take anything for granted. They work on everything so that they can be comfortable, be safe. I already described locus of control from external to internal. That is to say that wilderness therapy is particularly effective at moving locus of control from outside of oneself to inside of oneself. What I do makes a difference. We have a rites of passage model. Wilderness itself is a rite of passage. A lot of cultures in the history of humankind have at some point during adolescence kind of pushed the kids out to run them through a ceremony, an experience, and then bring them back in as adults, right? There's this moment when you go out to find yourself. When I say it's a sterile assessment environment, I don't mean physically or medically sterile. It's far from that. But it's sterile in the sense that you see the child in their natural habitat, so to speak. There are other children in the group that are struggling with various issues and behaviors, but we have eyes on them now. We're watching them. Sometimes I have students, once in a while, we have students end up in the program and they'll know somebody else in their group. That can happen. And parents usually are like, well, let's get them away from each other. They were negative influences on each other. And I always say, let's give it a chance first, because maybe we'll see what they're like together and we can treat it in vivo. It's like when you go to the mechanic and your car's making a noise, and then once you get in front of the mechanic, the car stops. That's kind of what treatment can be like sometimes. So let's hear the rattling of the car engine. Let's see it. I already mentioned self-efficacy. That is the idea that what I do makes a difference. It's vulnerable, like NASA Discover. It's outside of your comfort zone. You have to rely on each other. It is a team effort to camp out there. So you develop interdependence, you know, how to ask for help when you need help. I love it, maybe most of all, because students learn the futility of their old coping mechanisms. Their old escape routes become dead ends. And for the most part, it is a truism that we're not going to change unless we're uncomfortable enough in our current circumstances. It's like one of my favorite quotes about sobriety. People stop using drugs and alcohol for the same reason that they started. And that is to feel better. So when your old ways of operating, when you see how futile they are and that there is no escape from yourself, from your own life, you may be willing to try something different. And then, like I said, the shift from the enemy is outside of you to the enemy is within. You can see a young man in the picture, for those of you watching, making a Bodro fire by rubbing sticks together. That becomes a wonderful metaphor. Here's somebody's backpack in the wintertime. So you see, the more you work on it, the tighter it's packed, the more comfortable it'll be, the more loose and imbalanced it is, the more difficult, and that becomes its own metaphor. You also have to listen to staff who have more expertise than you. I have a picture here of just an empty field, and I put on this slide differentiation and distance. I want to make this point clearly, because the separation that happens in the beginning of wilderness therapy is an opportunity to set the foundation for the family's work. And the foundation is each person's individual work. What is each person's individual project? What's their problem? What's their contribution? We establish that first. Things get really complicated when you bring everybody back together. So we start off with letters only, and letters just to mom and dad or the caregivers, whoever the caregivers are. You can expand to siblings if the therapists think it works, or even extended family members or friends farther along in the program. We have phone calls that get introduced. When we're not experiencing a pandemic, there are visits to the program, mid-program or after. Now we're trying to use some video and some FaceTime video conferencing when we can. It's become a little bit challenging, like everything else during the pandemic. But this distance becomes this kind of physical thing, where everybody gets clear on their own boundaries and their own self and their own project first. And then we reintegrate them. The same way when you go to a hospital after a car accident, you're whisked away into the emergency room, you get stabilized, and then you can have visitors. Then you can move to a room where the visiting list gets larger. Then you go to rehab, right? It's kind of like that. Letter writing therapy. In fact, a blog just came out today about letter writing. I'd encourage you to look at it on our webpage by Eleanor Priest. Letter writing therapy is some of the most effective wilderness therapy that I've ever seen. What are the goals in wilderness therapy? I think most people get that it's a wake-up call. You have their attention. And there's this idea that people don't change until they want to change. Well, sometimes interventions create a new bottom, right? If you lose your job, or if your spouse says to you, enough is enough, if you get a DUI, those become, for many people, a part of their bottom, the point where they want to stop digging and start asking for help. So wilderness therapy or any intervention can be a new bottom. You're trying to raise the bottom, is the phrase. You buy some time. You're in a crisis. You know things aren't working at home. You're finally at the point where you're ready to move. So you buy some time. You get stability. You interrupt the crisis. And then you can take a step back and do some assessment, education, and realize what the long-term decision is. There's obviously a therapeutic benefit. I think the thing that's probably most misunderstood about wilderness therapy more than anything else is that it's a sophisticated clinical model. Yes, it's primitive outside, but that's where the primitive nature stops. We use all of the traditional psychotherapies, evidence-based therapies that are out there, but we just do it with this wonderful delivery method, this wonderful backdrop of wellness therapy. You get feedback to the families, the consultants, the next step. What works, what doesn't. You begin to establish a family plan, family work, through your letters, through your podcast, through your webinars, through your assignments. You start to prepare people for the next step. I've identified these stages that students go through, from resistance, outright, you know, resistance, to resigned, being resigned to it, to accepting it, to eventually investing it. Related to that, people ask the question, will my child forgive me? The answer is, your child will forgive you when they grow up. If you're held hostage by that question, will my child forgive me? Very simply put, you're asking them to take care of you. So we turn it over to them. You're going to make mistakes as a parent every day, before, during, and after this process. And when we grow up, we forgive the people that have hurt us, even the ones who have done it intentionally. And this is not intentional. There's a softening effect, behaviorally speaking. The rough, sharp edges are taken off demonstrative behaviors, because out there in the wilderness, there's nowhere to go. There's nothing to, you're not interrupting math or science, because therapy is first in wilderness therapy. Well, safety, of course, first. But then after that, therapy is the number one priority above all else. So negative behaviors start to diminish. And you qualify for a different level of care. You might be able to go home after wilderness. You might qualify for a program, and for a program that has certain freedoms that you wouldn't have qualified for if you hadn't gone to wilderness. So changing the levels of care in this process, and then learning to socialize. It's not just individual therapy, it's living with, you know how hard it is to live with the same people for weeks and weeks and weeks on end, and the same staff for 8 days. See, we don't have staff that come in for 12-hour shifts or 8-hour shifts. They come in for 8-day shifts. So you have to deal with it. You can't just hold your breath and wait for the cool staff to come. There's an assessment. Both objective testing is available, but also the natural observation. And substance abuse is eradicated in the short term. A typical day. Everybody always asks me, what's a typical day look like? So I made this slide. You wake up at 8. You have orientation, organization at 8:20. You might have a mindfulness or meditation activity. Have breakfast at 9. You're going to have a morning group, maybe, group therapy. Hike for a couple of hours, lunch. Each day you have some personal time to work on your curriculum. You have emotional curriculum, academic curriculum, and what we call hard skills curriculum. You hike in the afternoon, you arrive at the new campsite. You have chores, set up the camp, fire building, dinner, group therapy again at night. And then at night, if there's time, stories, games, or music, guitars, things like that at night. All day long, a group can happen at any time. We call that a standing group. Individual sessions happen throughout the week with staff and therapists. Layover days are when you don't move campsites. Those are the days that therapists are there, maybe one other day per week. You get laundry twice a week. You have to do showers twice a week. You get new food every day, but your two main food distributions happen twice a week, and you have to manage it as a group and as an individual. You have personal time every day, like I said, to work on either your hard skills, which are like learning how to build a Bojo fire, or learning to communicate using the I feel statements would be a soft skill. And then you have therapy assignments given by the therapist and the staff, books, reading assignments, workbooks, various focuses. We also have academic curriculum, letters to and from home, solos. That's a whole nother broadcast. Chores, of course, mindfulness and meditation, service. And ultimately, everything becomes grist for the therapeutic mill. Everything. Wilderness is the delivery method. But the traditional models of therapy that every therapist, every program knows about, that's what gets done out there. We're mostly informed by attachment theory, Joseph Campbell's idea of the hero's journey, developmental psychology, meaning understanding how children develop, the stages they're going through, family systems work, play therapy, because play therapy understands the children. And in this case, you can think of anyone under the age of 25 as a child. The children communicate through doing, through play, through their activities. So we're informed by play therapy and, of course, many other evidence-based theories. Dialectical behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, EMDR, brain spotting, ACT, the list is endless. Not only are the theories and the interventions themselves evidence-based, but we've added more and more and more to the research in wilderness therapy. And that I think there's a certain kind of readiness for families when their children, you know, when your child's not there and we have him or them or her, I think you're particularly in a space where you can listen and learn. You know, the amount of people that show up to these broadcasts and listen to them afterwards, that do their work, is significant. And I think because the child is kind of out there doing their thing, it leaves you with an extra readiness to do your own work and figure out what that means. We try to focus on the whole health, meditation, mindfulness, diet. They eat, for the most part, a much better diet than they eat at home. We try to do organic. We try to do local. We reduce sugars and preservatives. We have all kinds of menus available, from kosher to vegan to vegetarian. So that you're really inserting a lot of things. You know, if you just took the average teen and you got them 9 hours of sleep at night, improved their diet, and took them off screens, we all know that young person's mental health is going to take, after a lot of complaining, is going to take a leap forward. Wilderness does that inherently. In Joseph Campbell's model, he talks about the motif of death. And he's talking about the metaphorical death. And in storytelling, this has actually helped me when I read about Joseph Campbell. In storytelling, in a story, when there's a death, oftentimes it's a metaphor for the old life making way for the new life. Somebody gave me a book when I was during one of my few midlife crises. Somebody gave me a book called Death of a Hero, Birth of a Soul. It's written for men kind of in their midlife. And it's that point in our life when we give up the life we have planned to embrace the life that is waiting for us. Like Joseph Campbell talks about, you meet your magical helpers. The students talk about the staff being the most important thing that changes them. Parents talk about the therapists. There are peers. There are characters in the books that you're reading. And then you become a master of these two worlds. That's the outcome of the hero's journey. You find your story, and then you return and you share it with other people. So the foreword to the book, you know, the hero in the wilderness, is to say there's this beautiful, powerful, effective intervention that we call wilderness therapy that's just like life, only more. I told the story. They called me to the Boy Scouts many years ago. I'm not really an outdoorsy guy, but I worked at a wilderness therapy program, so compared to the average person, I was very outdoorsy. And one of the things they wanted me to do was to set up a series of winter camping. And we live in Utah, so winter camping is significant. It's one of the patches that the kids get. I was never in Boy Scouts, but somehow you can get this patch for winter camping. So of course I cheated and had one of my most experienced field staff kind of help me set it up. And we went up into one of the canyons here in the middle of winter and set up our camp on 10 feet of snow, snowpack, right? And it was a tough night. They were having snowball fights. They were having a great time, but we were trying to explain to them, look, those snowballs on your shirts and in your, that you just put down your friend's pants, when the sun goes down, you're going to be freezing. And we had to keep them. It was like herding cats, right? And then we had dinner to cook, and we're trying to put the fire together. And we end up eating dinner, and the dinners are half frozen and half burnt. And then we get all the kids dried. It takes us hours. We get them into bed. We make sure that they're safe in the dry, when they're dry. And I turn to the staff next to me, who goes camping on his vacation weeks in between his 8-day shifts. His name is Sean. And I said to him, Sean, I don't know how you do this. And he said, without looking at me, he said, it just doesn't get any more real than this. This is as real as it gets. I remember Clay, ironically, the first staff that I ever talked to, of the first and the first time I was introduced to wilderness therapy in that first day. I said, "Clay, what is wilderness therapy?" He said, "Brad, it's learning to live on the ground in the present moment and deal with what is. Most people," he explained to me, "live 2 miles above the earth and aren't connected and grounded to the moment, to their lives." And I kept, you know, I thought, well, that's a little bit heady for me. That's a little bit metaphorical. I'm not sure that helps me with my to-do list for the day. But Clay was telling me the same thing Sean was. Wilderness therapy grounds you. You can't escape it. And for me, that has become, has created a guiding impact in my life all the way through with my own children and with the clients that I work with. Somebody writes, not really a question, but wanted to comment under your goals slide. Everything you mentioned is super relevant to our family, but perhaps the biggest take home for us, our teen transferred from Evoke end of July, was learning how to communicate more effectively, having a vocabulary for expressing feelings, and learning how to listen, deep, active listening to understand versus respond. These skills were invaluable and put us in a greater position to continue the work while our child was at a residential treatment center. That's the beauty, is you start writing, you start with the education, you see your part in it and where you connect with your child. And then you build on that as you go with more and more contact. But that becomes, I said it with my son, I want a bridge over to his world. I want some language, some common set of tools and ideas that we can connect on. And that's what wilderness therapy became, among other things, for us and our family. Somebody writes, I'm a big advocate for the healing and possibility of wilderness therapy, having had 3 kids go through it. However, how is that experience transcended to life outside of wilderness therapy? I mean, that's the challenge. Anytime an intervention starts to depend on metaphor, it takes work to generalize it back into practical every day. Those who do, my son is 28 now. And my son still will tell me to this day, he just graduated with his master's degree. He'll tell me to this day that there are a handful of lessons that he took from wilderness that he lives by today. And he was 13, turned 14 in the wilderness, and he's 28 right now. So the more work you do, he's actually 29, I'm sorry. The more work you do, the more open, the easier you see the application to your life. But it's all there. And it takes work. It takes work. All right, I'll get to the rest of the questions next time. I do want to go back to this. I showed it to you last night, but that podcast by Adam Grant was, I thought, I love it when science catches up with intuition. Both of my books are available on Amazon and Audible. So you can get The Journey of the Rogue Parent or The Audacity to Be You. I also did the audiobook myself for The Audacity to Be You. Somebody just pulled out of our February in-person intensive. So if you were on the waiting list, they moved to another month. If you're on the waiting list or you want to get in, I'm running the one in February 24th to 28th. Contact intensives at evoketherapy.com. We also have online options that we're offering that we started during COVID that we found are a great fit for many people. They're cheaper in cost, they're shorter in time, so it's easier for more people to get to it. We also have an in-person Finding You 2. So if you've been to a Finding You 1, I'm going to be running the Finding You 2 in May. I'm looking very forward to that. We have a spring pursuits trip. It's kind of like a hybrid. It's not primitive living. It's just short little trips anywhere between a few days to 30 days for families or adults. You can also use it for between visits. We have a multi-sport trip coming up in March for spring break for young adults 18 and older. We have support groups for alumni from our wilderness program and our intensives program. So the next online support group for families is tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. for wilderness families, February 4th, 6:30 p.m. If you're an intensive alumni, February 9th at 6 p.m., just contact Malia at evoketherapy.com if you want to register, want to find out more. We ask all current parents to please attend 6 12-step support groups. Any combinations of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or adultchildren.org. Also, you can go to refugerecovery.org or NAMI.org to get classes and resources that are cheap or for free in your local area at your local chapter. All of these broadcasts are available on the Finding on any podcast app and Spotify. You just search Finding You at Evoke Therapy Podcast, any of your podcast app, or you can just go on a computer to soundcloud.com. On Instagram and Twitter, you can find us at Evoke Therapy, and you can find at Evoke Therapy Intensives on Instagram. On Facebook, you can search Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives, and of course, we have new content on our blog. Today's newest blog was on letter writing, so it's relevant to what we're talking about tonight. All right, folks. This is a little bit messed up, this slide, so I'm not even going to show it to you. My next broadcast will be February 8th, where it'll be a live Q&A. I had to switch it around because I was sick last night and had to reschedule for tonight. So February 8th, 6:30 p.m., we'll be doing live Q&A. Anything left over here, you can invite siblings of your child. You can invite extended family and friends if you want to, so they can listen and ask any questions they want. Thank you for joining us. I am grateful for wellness therapy and what it has taught me in my life. I feel like I've learned more than any of my students, or as much as any of my students and my family. So I'm grateful for what it's taught me. And I had no idea what I was getting into when I started. So that's often how it goes for us, isn't it? Thanks, folks. Thanks for joining me. You're welcome. Have a great evening, and I'll talk to you next week. Take care. Bye-bye. Shadows slowly chill.